Well, hello, and welcome back to Stuff We Like. We have a lot to cover today, so sit back and enjoy the show. The latest news on the Corner Coffee House. The Corner Coffee House in Green Lane, Dagenham, Essex, is now open. We have a team of baristas, all volunteers, and I myself have spent some time helping to manage the place and helping to set up all the processes and the systems, and we've still got loads to do. But the coffee still tastes great, the cakes are still amazing, and if you ever find yourself in that corner of the woods in London, then please pop in and see us. It's about 20 minutes away from Stratford International by train to Goodmayes, and then you can walk along to Green Lane or Chadwell Heath and then walk down from the Chadwell Heath High Road down past the station to Goodmayes itself. And we're on the corner of Green Lane and Bennett's Castle Lane, and it really is an amazing little place. The other day I found myself in my old stomping ground in London, just off Fleet Street in a place called Salisbury Court. And I used to work there back in the late 90s for Reuters. And just opposite the place where I worked was a small Italian restaurant called Casella. Every Friday, I and a colleague of mine would go to Casella, either on the way to work or halfway through the morning, if we felt like it, to buy ourselves a Casella cappuccino. And I remember back in the late 90s, I had had cappuccinos many, many times growing up in the 70s and 80s. They gradually became part of the restaurant scene. And the art was to be able to drink a cappuccino without puncturing the lovely foam on top when you had to put sugar in. Of course, I stopped having sugar when I later on in my life. And so that ceased to become an issue. But cappuccinos were much of a muchness. You'd get watery ones, milky ones. You know, they were average. They were an interesting drink, but nothing too special. Until I went to Casella. And I suddenly realised what an espresso-based drink really could be. And this was in 1998. So, relatively recently. I suddenly realised espresso could be really rich and special. And it was there I discovered that. And so every Friday, I would spend my £1.50, whatever it was, and treat myself to a Casella cappuccino in the morning and bring it back. Now, it's not called a coffee shop. It's actually a restaurant and sandwich bar. And as far as I know, it's run by an Italian family. I don't really know a great deal about them. It's just that as the great conglomerates opened their coffee shops all over London, mentioning no particular names, because they're all conglomerates, let's face it, I always used to go back to Casella and smile, because it's a small family-run place which serves exceptional espresso and really good cappuccino. And sometimes when I go into London, I do like to find out places, search out these independent, small family-run businesses, because sometimes you get just that something special from those kinds of places. I like to ask people about their five favourite films. And as I've said earlier, I can talk about as many favourite novels as I like, as many favourite films as I like, as many favourite pieces of classical music that I like. And I'm a particular fan of Mozart. I love his music. I find it particularly intriguing how one man with a bunch of orchestral arrangements in his head could create something so complex, so interlocking. When you listen to the bass lines and the counterpoints and all the other bits and pieces of a Mozart piece, even something simple like Eine kleine Nachtmusik, you realise here's a man who just understood music more than anyone else at his time and probably more than anyone else since. It's quite astonishing to listen to a piece of music that you have your A, B, A, B, C, A, B sort of patterns as he plays a piece, then he repeats it, and then he'll play a variation, then he'll repeat that, then he'll go back to the original, and then he'll play a variation on the variation. But equally how appealing it is, how addictive it is, how enjoyable it is, because there are so many diverse motifs running throughout any piece of Mozart's music. I particularly like his piano concertos 21 and 22. I have the versions recorded by Vladimir Ashkenazy, the amazing concert pianist, and they are just wonderful. They are atmospheric, driving, powerful, light in places. There's just so many textures in the music. It's quite incredible. It's eternal music. I mean, this stuff doesn't age. It goes on and on. And when it comes to movies, one particular movie I absolutely love is Amadeus, which is a film about the life of Mozart. Now, those of you who know what Amadeus is about, it's essentially not necessarily just about Mozart. It involves Mozart, but it's about another composer called Salieri, who lived at the time of Mozart. And it's a fictional piece. There's no evidence to say it ever existed. But what the playwright Peter Schaffer did when he wrote the play Amadeus was explore themes of divine inspiration, talent, genius, and character. And he explores the whole thing of what if a brilliant mind, someone as amazing as Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, could be a superb musician, write music which sends people into the stratosphere, and yet is an absolute pain as an individual, a very difficult person to get on with, very spoilt, annoying, irritating, brattish, the sort of guy you would not want to spend a day with. And what if you had another composer who is devoted to his art and his craft, and he worked daily at it, and he prayed, and he felt God had given him this gift, and yet when he comes across Mozart, he realizes his gift is nothing like Mozart's, and yet Mozart doesn't seem to have to work at it. He just plays incredible music, and Salieri starts getting jealous, and that jealousy ferments into something bigger and more deep and more sinister. It's a gripping movie because the play is phenomenal. And actually, I would recommend anyone go see the play first, if you can. But as it's not often on anywhere, then see the film. It's a pretty good version. And basically, it does a very good justice to the characters. They're American, the guys who play Mozart and Salieri. Tom Hulce and F. Murray Abraham, two great American actors. And it's directed by Milos Forman, but it has a lot of atmosphere. It's set in the time, Mozart's time, the 18th century, of course, in Vienna. But it has Mozart's music running throughout it. And as a character, Mozart is irritating. He is annoying. He is the kind of guy you really wouldn't want to spend a day with. And yet, Tom Hulce still manages to make you feel sorry for him, to make you feel compassion for him. Here is this incredible genius who finds other people just almost intolerable because they can't see the world from his viewpoint. And you see this guy who is twisted to murderous rage by his jealousy of Mozart, Salieri, played by F. Murray Abraham, for which he won an Oscar, I think. And somehow you see him, you feel sorry for him as well. You feel compassion for him. It's a film which takes you on this journey, which is very dark and, as I say, has no basis in historical fact. Nevertheless, asks questions of genius and music and talent and divine inspiration and God, sin, heaven, hell, death, salvation, all these things all in one. Very entertaining, very compelling, superbly photographed film. The film's themes made me think a lot about character and gift, which is something that runs throughout it. Can a person who is phenomenally talented still be a really difficult, awkward, terrible person? And to what extent do people interpret talent as character? So they see someone who's incredibly talented and think, oh, he must be an amazing person. And it really is quite sobering, involving and enjoyable. Amadeus. Get it out and watch it now. I'm now wandering through the wonderful 18th century courtyard of Somerset House. There's a statue, various drops, spectacular Georgian architecture all around me, and the wonderful fountains, which have a mind of their own. It's a series of fountains stretched out in the courtyard where normally in the winter time there is ice skating. It's a beautiful, wonderful place to just wander around, relax, spend a little bit of time away from the hustle and bustle of London. It's just off the Strand. There's a lovely coffee shop, Fernandez and Wells, which serves a wonderful cup of coffee and quite a lot of fantastic food as well. And it's a place just to take stock and look around you. There are some tables outside in the courtyard overlooking the rapidly bouncing fountains. And just behind me is the Courtauld Gallery, which contains the collection of Samuel Courtauld, who collected lots of art in the turn of the last century. And a lot of its impressionistic masterpieces, such as Gauguin. There's a current exhibition about Courtauld's collection of Gauguin paintings, but also you can see original Manet's there, and my own personal favourite, the wonderful Lac d'Annecy, The Lake of Annecy by Paul Cézanne. The Courtauld Gallery is part of the whole Somerset House complex, just off the Strand. A beautiful place just to hang out and watch water falling, if you like, that sort of thing, or to admire the architecture, or to have a coffee and a lunch at Fernandez and Wells, or to see the stunning artwork in the Courtauld Gallery. Recently, I managed to catch up with old podcast regular Tom Ronan to ask him a few questions about Bali. We spoke in a coffee shop. So, Tom, tell me all about Bali.
As a means of introduction. Well, I went to Bali. It's a bit strange because we're actually conducting this interview at a Costa in King's Cross on a rather grey November afternoon. So Bali seems about as far removed from here as is possible to be, which I guess it is. I'm not holding this too close, am I? Well, I went there on holiday. I was lucky enough to go there on holiday about 3 or 4 months ago. This is whilst I was still living in Australia, in Perth, in Western Australia, which I've banged on about in the past, I believe, in a previous...
You have. Tell me, Tom, just out of interest, why do so many Australians go to Bali?
Well, Bali is the sort of... It's funny, because from the UK, Bali seems this... hold on to it, sorry. Seems this very distant, exotic location, which it is, probably because it's so far away. If you're actually living in Australia, particularly in Western Australia, Bali is the sort of the equivalent of going to Benidorm or Torremolinos or whatever. It's a cheap package holiday place, particularly if you live in Western Australia. It's a cheap place to go. The Australian dollar's been particularly strong in recent years, so it makes it very cheap to go there. So it's a place people go. It's actually cheaper to go on, say, a package holiday for 10 days or whatever in Bali than it would be to go, for a 3 or 4 night stay to Sydney or Melbourne from Perth, which is why people go up there for that kind of trip. So that's why.
What's it like as a place?
Well, I mean, Bali, geographically, I think it's located... It's an Indonesian island. Sorry, I'm just dipping my... I'm doing my tea and talking about Bali at the same time. It's an Indonesian island, I think, geographically located somewhere between Java and Lombok. I think I'm right in saying. So I don't know what the population is there. I should have checked this first. But I think it's around about 3 million people or something like that. So that's where it's sort of geographically located. Despite the fact that it's an Indonesian island, which would obviously suggest that it's Indonesian being a Muslim country, it's actually mostly Buddhist, with a bit of Hindu on there as well, I think, so it's like a sort of Buddhist island, traditionally. What's there? Well, if you're going there for... I mean, it's obviously a tropical island, so it's beaches and palm trees and all the rest of it. For those going on a sort of an El Cheapo, you know, lager it up type holiday,
then you go to somewhere like Kuta, which is like the sort of holiday, you know, backpackers, bars on the beach, cheap Megaluf places to stay, Megaluf, that type of place, nightclubs, cheap alcohol, possibly laced with ethanol, unfortunately. It's that kind of deal. So that's where the people go for a cheap, you know, bash holiday, go out there, you know, have a good time, go down to the pool, all that sort of stuff. From there, actually, when I was over there, which is more of a sort of holiday makers Bali, there is, however, still a sort of more of the traditional Bali, which is probably a little bit harder to find in this day and age, and you have to kind of get away from the crowds a little bit. So where I was staying over there, I went over there actually about 20 years ago. I went on a holiday, so this is actually the second time I've been there, but this time I stayed up, there's a place called Ubud, which is up in the mountains in the centre of the island. It's like sort of a big volcano in the centre of the island, so it's up in the actual mountainous area, which is, it's about an hour and a half's drive. You arrive at Denpasar, is the main airport there. Denpasar's not that far from Kuta, which is the sort of, you know, the holiday sort of area. And then you get away from that and you go a drive up this sort of the main road up to Ubud, which actually passes endless amounts, and I mean endless, thousands of little places on the side of the road selling statues and stone artefacts, which are obviously exported around the world because you see them everywhere. And obviously they all come from there. I've never seen so many statues of Buddha and various gods. Just unbelievable. You go after, you must pass the thousands of these places. Anyway, so up to Ubud, I was staying at a place called the Hanging Gardens, which is like a sort of resorty type place, which is actually, not actually in Ubud, it's probably about half an hour's drive out of Ubud. So it's really out in the sort of jungle, effectively. Absolutely gorgeous place to stay, fantastic. I mean, you've got, stayed in like a little sort of thatched chalet type place, overlooking the valley, very unspoilt, absolutely fantastic. I mean, just quiet, peaceful. You've got that sort of tropical type weather, so it never gets, doesn't get that hot, doesn't get that cold. You get the rain comes in a little bit, depending on what time of the year it is. But just gorgeous, fantastic. Ubud is actually supposed to be the sort of art and cultural centre of Bali, so they do sort of a lot of sort of paintings and artworks and things down there. There's markets and stuff like that. Where I was staying was actually sort of more resorty up there. But I mean, frankly, if you're sat there by one of those horizon pools overlooking the jungle, you don't really want to do too much. You just sit there and it's,
and enjoy,
you know,
the
comes
enjoy
to you.
The
yeah, totally gorgeous.
So, do you get a chance to trek in the mountains, or?
I did a little bit. I mean, did an excursion, like a guide-led excursion, which took us around some of the local villages, which are absolutely beautiful. It's just near a little school and stuff like that. And so they're just these original Balinese villages, which are quite different from the sort of places you'd get down in sort of the main town. You know, with sort of dogs running around and kids running around and absolutely beautiful. The only sad thing is about it, there's an awful lot of litter. Because they've got such a lot of holiday makers there, especially in recent years, but they don't have the infrastructure there to get rid of all the litter. They're actually doing things about it now. So even in the really remote areas, despite the fact that it's so picturesque, palm trees and the paddy fields and the rest of it, you still find an awful lot of litter around, which is like quite heartbreaking, really.
It's interesting, because when I interviewed Hannah Walker about Nepal, she said similar things.
It's the problem you've got, I think, when you've got sort of mass transit tourism, which Bali is certainly parts of it, to an area which is still third world. And as I said, the infrastructure's not there. They don't have recycling stations in places where you can get rid of it easily, like other places might have. It's just simply not there. So the money goes into building hotels, almost certainly foreign-owned hotels. You know, they're not going to be particularly interested in protecting the environment. There is a business concern to look after the tourists going there. And I'm sure what she said about Nepal, I mean, I've seen photographs and, you know, of the base camps of Everest and the rest of it, and just tons and tons of rubbish everywhere. It's just, you know, it's terrible. And the same on Bali, I'm afraid.
So what do you think is the most spectacular thing you've seen in Bali?
I think just getting away, for me personally, I think getting away from the crowds and the rest of it. And there's some lovely beaches there, beautiful. We're talking about, went up to just a walk actually from where we were staying, down a valley crossed over a sort of rickety, rackety bridge made of two sort of pieces of bamboo strung together with the sort of running water underneath it. And you're thinking,
how far?
Well, not that far, but it didn't, when you're out in the middle of it, yeah, it might as well seem like Niagara Falls, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
It seemed like a long way down, and then sort of climbed up through this, up through the jungle, and it's real sort of Indiana Jones type stuff, because you get the sort of these statues, the Buddhist statues and the rest of it, all grown, overgrown by lichen, and the rest of it just standing there in a clearing in the jungle, climbing up and up and up, and came to this fantastic Buddhist temple, which is again has had sort of wooden doors and this beautiful, it was right up high overlooking the valley. Absolutely gorgeous, and sort of opened the doors up there, and was this old sort of Balinese guy who was a sort of, local holy man, if you like, who kind of looked after it. He was a sort of caretaker of it, and he sort of welcomed us in, and we spoke to him for a while, and there was nobody else there. It was spectacular, because you tend to go to these places, and, you know, you go with the crowds, and they're picturesque, but I think if you're going with everybody else, it's... And this wasn't, we just sort of stumbled upon this place, and for me, and after that, having been to this one Buddhist temple, there's thousands of Buddhist temples you can go and see on Bali or any of those islands, but I didn't want to go and see another one after that, because when you go see one that's just so beautiful and in your mind this is how these things are, what you've seen in the tourist photos, I don't want to spoil it by going to another one. I thought, that's it, I'm not going to see another one. Saw that quite early on, and I thought, that's it, I've seen this beautiful Balinese temple, I don't want to go to another one. That for me, that was the experience, and that was it. So I think that was probably the highlight for me, was that. Or a second highlight was that obviously the sort of pressure on the wildlife in places like Bali because of tourists and the rest of it. So I think a lot of the animals and the rest of it have been drawn more to the centre of things, getting away from the coast. And they still have wild monkeys up there. Don't ask me the species, I'm not entirely sure. But they're like proper nervous wild monkeys, not the sort of ones you'd get, I don't know, on your boards or whatever, where they're coming on to, you know, break the aerial off your car and come down to food and all the rest of it. These are nervous wild monkeys. And so talking to one of the hotel staff then, he was saying, because I heard some noises in the night, like on the roof and stuff, and I asked him what it was. He said, oh, it'll be the monkeys. They move from one side of the mountain, sort of where we were staying, to the other. It's, you know, they're territorial and they move across. And I saw one fleetingly from a distance when I think we first got there, and thought, well, that'll probably be it, because they are quite nervous. You know, they say they're not what, they're wild monkeys and they're nervous of people. Anyway, so one day I was sitting there in the afternoon, and lo and behold, this monkey, and heard this noise. Actually, it wasn't in the afternoon, I can tell you, right? It was in the morning. Heard a noise outside, and there was a big, I don't know what it was, but it was obviously the leader of the pack, quite a lot bigger than the other ones, was obviously going ahead, sort of scouting, just sat there. And he was sat there looking in into where we were staying, and I was kind of looking at him, and he was looking at me, and it was a very, very strange situation. He was kind of... And then moments later... the rest of the shoal, I think that's what they call a shoal of monkeys.
Mm.
No, they don't.
Who knows?
Pack, flock.
A bunch of monkeys,
not showing my ignorance there at all. All came across and sort of gingerly made their way over the roof, and you could hear them on the roof sort of scratching around, and off they moved. And that was fantastic, because they weren't, as I said, they weren't domesticated monkeys used to people looking for food. They were doing what they've probably done for hundreds of years, making their way from one side of the mountain to the other, and it just so happened to be that this chalet we were staying was in the way, and they, you know, were nervous and they moved on. Fantastic. Because you don't often see animals like that in the wild like that, and it was beautiful, really.
That's
good.
Great. Cool, thank you, Tom.
Oh, is that it? I think I said that last time.
The irrepressible Tom Ronan there, talking in a coffee shop in King's Cross about his experiences in Bali. And that brings us to the close of this episode of Stuff We Like. But please don't go before you follow me on Twitter, at David Simmons, Pinterest Stuff We Like, where you can see all the stuff that we talk about every week. And you can also email me, dhsimmons@outlook.com. I'm David Simmons, and this podcast has been brought to you by Absolute Productions, a division of Absolute Communications.